sense of this work is understanding multi-portal SLE, which at this point quite a number of people have looked at. So the original sort of question that we're looking at was first looked at by Cardi, and that is if you have percolation. This isn't percolation, this is the easing model, but if you had percolation and you had white boundary conditions on two sides, what's the probability that there's a crossing or equivalently an SLE? And if you had two copies of SLE 6 connecting those four points, what's the probability that they hook up this way versus the other way? So if it's phrased strictly in terms of SLEs, not strictly speaking a well-defined question, because you can have different discrete models which have the same limits and the same marginal distributions if you on these interfaces, if you condition them on a certain connection topology. And Cardi gave some examples of such models. But so what we're going to be looking at is an example of some particular discrete models for which the interfaces converge to different types of SLE, and we're going to look at the crossing probabilities. Okay, so we're only going to look at certain particular values of kappa, but our goal is to understand what happens when you have large numbers of boundary points and understand these cases really well. And so we're going to do this through trees and the double dimer model, which isn't currently known to converge to SLE4. But it turns out that the crossing probabilities that we get for the double dimer model satisfy a certain equation. And using that characterization of the Gaussian free field by Schramm and Sheffield, we can show that these crossing probabilities satisfy a certain equation that they produce, and therefore the crossing probabilities are the same for these two models. Okay, so almost the entire talk is going to live in the discrete world. So this is a finite planar graph. This is called a circular planar graph because it's embedded inside of a circle, and there are certain marked nodes on the boundary, marked vertices, which are called nodes, and we're going to assume that they're numbered in the positive direction. This is a spanning tree of this circular planar graph. And Kirchhoff showed how to compute the number of spanning trees. So this matrix is the negative Laplacian of that graph. So there's a non-zero matrix entry. The two corresponding vertices are connected by an edge. And the row sums are zero. And Kirchhoff showed that if you strike out a row in the corresponding column, that this gives the number of spanning trees of that graph. You can also strike out a number of rows in the corresponding set of columns, and this gives the set of spanning forests rooted at the nodes corresponding to the rows and columns that you struck out. Okay, so we're going to be looking at objects that are called groves. Here are four examples of groves and two non-groves. A grove is a spanning forest such that every tree contains one of the marked nodes. This is not a grove because it contains a cycle. And this one isn't a grove because the spanning tree does not contain a node. Okay, so the different groves induce partitions on the set of nodes, and it's these partitions that we're going to be looking at. also one of the motivations for this work is that Carol Spire, we're looking at groves on this graph with this partition type, and these have all kinds of interesting connections to combinatorics. And so, of course, we're looking at more general graphs and other partition types.
So, sir, would you mind me what the vertical line means in this notation?
Okay, so this denotes a partition, and so there's one part containing 1 and 15. The vertical line means that you're now looking at the next part. So this is the part containing 1 and 15. And there's another part containing 2 and 14.
So there's like different trees in this forest, different whatever, three different trees in this forest.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so going back to our original graph, there are three groves of type 1, 2, 3, meaning there are three trees. There are four groves of type, or 1 and 2, or 1 part, and 3 is by itself. And these are how many groves there are of the different types. And our goal is to compute the probability of the partition types if you have a grove chosen uniformly at random from all those groves. Okay, so I gave this talk once, and it wasn't until the very end that somebody asked me what a planar partition is. So I have a slide for this now. So these two partitions are planar because they can be realized by planar graphs that live inside the disk here. So you can imagine a path between 1 and 4 within the graph and also between 1 and 3. But this partition can't be realized because there's no way for 1 and 3 to be connected and between 4 to also be connected. And these are also called non-crossing partitions. The number of these things is given by the nth Catalan number. Okay, so if you have a portion of the Cartesian lattice, this is an example of a uniformly random grove. This particular one had four trees. One has eight nodes. One was in a tree by itself. 2, 7, and 8 were in one tree. 3, 4, and 5 were in another tree, and 6 was by itself.
Somehow I have forgotten what is a grove. I mean, if I take any spanning forest, that I would say will always induce a partition on these numbered external sites, doesn't it?
Yes, but we only look at the spanning forest with the property that every tree contains one of these numbered nodes on the boundary.
At least one. Oh,
at least
there's
one.
No trees that have no
overlay
spans.
Right.
Okay.
I think I've asked this before last time, David. How compared to just identifying the points in a spanning tree? It kind of looks like a spanning tree if you identify the points on the boundary.
If you identify some of them.
So it's not quite.
I mean, for example, you don't want to identify 2 and 8 because then you'd have a loop.
Oh, I see. See, identify the funny. Yeah, right, you're right. Okay. That's what it means.
Well, for the same reason, you wouldn't want to root in that.
You wouldn't want to what?
You wouldn't want to root at the...
Right, so identifying all the nodes is the same as rooting the forest at those nodes. And in which case, you would have the partition corresponding to every item being in its own part. Okay, so this is to give a hint for why this might be connected to SLA2. So here, this is a graph in which there are 16 nodes, of which only 8 of them are numbered. This is a long extended node. These are small nodes. And this is a random grove with the property that all the small nodes are in a doubleton part, and all the large nodes are in a singleton part. And if you look at the paths connecting the small nodes, it has the property that if you erase one of the paths and keep all the other ones, this path is distributed according to a loop erased random walk with absorbing boundary conditions starting from here and ending here. And then using a Lawler, Schramm, and Werner connection between loop erased random walk and SLE2, see that it's related to SLE2.
So it's this green one, for example, is SLE2 in which domain?
In the domain that you get by cutting the red path,
okay.
I'm sorry, the blue path, the red path, and the brown path. Okay, and so here, this is, in this graph, there are four nodes. And in this particular case, so what's drawn here is the outer boundary of the spanning tree. And there are three trees, and I don't know if you can see them, but there's one tree containing this node, there's one tree containing this node, and there's one tree connecting these two. And what you're seeing here is the green is one side of the tree, and the blue is the other side of the tree. And then using the Lawler, Schramm, and Werner connection between this outer boundary, or the count curve of the spanning tree in SLE8, you can see that there's a connection to SLE8 if we understand these groves. So in this particular case, if you have a very large grid, and you have this geometry, the probability of this particular configuration converges to 2 minus root 2 over 8. Okay, so the other object that we're going to be talking about is the double dimer model. So here again, there's a planar graph, which in this case is the grid. We're assuming it's bipartite this time. There are special vertices on the outer face, which are called nodes. And every vertex has degree 2, except for the nodes which have degree 1, and we allow double digits. And the weight of the configuration is 2 to the number of loops. So the, in this case, we get pairing on the nodes, which are connected by the chains. So one is paired to 8, 3 and 4 are paired, 2 and 5, and 6 and 7.
Do the double short loops, where you just go up and back, do that also get a weighting?
No. Okay, so the reason it's called the double dimer model is that comes from two dimer configurations, and the reason for the weighting of 2 to the number of loops is because for each loop you have two choices as to which edges go into which copy. And if you carefully choose which of the nodes go into the left copy, which go into the right copy, each one only goes into one, then every double dimer configuration from the previous slide occurs with the appropriate weight. And the appropriate choice turns out to be if you have the black odd number ones going to the left and the even white numbered ones going to the left and the other ones going to the right. So if you let Z, PW denote the number of dimer configurations in this graph, CWB, you know, the number of configurations in this graph, and then the product just gives the weighted sum of double dimer configurations.
And what's the condition for BW, let's say?
The odd black ones and even white ones.
Only for the nodes?
Only for the nodes.
Oh.
interested in planar pairings. So this pairing would never occur, and of course this isn't a pairing. But the number of such configurations is still a Catalan number, but now n is only half as large. So we're assuming that there are two n boundary nodes. Okay, and this is just a fun calculation that we did. So here, if you have the upper half plane, and there are nodes at evenly spaced locations, which we may as well call the integers, and the mesh size goes to zero, you can ask what's the probability that a given node is paired to the neighbor to the right, and this turns out to be forward with pi squared.
Fixed number of nodes, though.
No, the number of nodes goes to infinity.
No, fixed number of boundary nodes?
No, it goes to infinity. So this is the upper half plane. There's a boundary node at each integer, the alternating color, and the mesh size goes to zero.
So that's to the right. So it's 8 over pi squared that would have a nearest neighbor?
Yes. Okay, so we're going to return to groves. And so the graph that we had before, we can view as an electric network. Each edge is a resistor. And the probabilities of the different groves we can express in terms of the electrical properties of the network. And so the first electrical property you might think of measuring is the electrical resistance between a pair of nodes. And of course, that's symmetric in the nodes. And this formula goes back to Kirchhoff. He showed that the electrical resistance here can be, well, another way to look at it is if you regard 5 and 2 as being nodes and all these other marked vertices you view as internal vertices, then the probability that a random group has 5 and 2 in separate parts divided by the probability that they're together, this is the resistance between 5 and 2. It turns out that there are convenient set of variables to work with, or the current response, current responses. So here you put 1 volt at node, a given node, and 0 volts at all the other nodes, and measure the current that flows out of a given node. And these are known as the negatives of the entries of the Dirichlet to Neumann matrix. And it's not clear from this definition, but these are also symmetric.
Symmetric in what?
In the nodes.
Yeah, but you know you have all 8 nodes.
Okay, so what I mean here
five,
is that
5 is special, but the others are
yeah,
special.
Why is it L5 2? What's special about 2?
There's nothing special about 2. So what's being shown here is if you have node 5 is at 1 volt, and we're looking at the current that comes out of node 2.
Oh,
that's L5 2.
Okay.
Okay, so this is the Kirchhoff matrix from before, and this has been drawn in a block form. So the rows and columns of this block correspond to the nodes, and for the other rows and columns are the internal vertices. And if you apply a certain voltage, you get certain currents that flow. And by Kirchhoff's current law, the currents on the internal vertices are zero. So we have this block equation. And we can solve for the internal voltages. This. And given these internal voltages, you can then solve for the currents in terms of the voltages on the nodes. And this is the current response matrix. And because this matrix is symmetric, H is the transpose of G, That's why this current response matrix is symmetric. Okay, so so why don't we start by computing the probability that you get a spanning tree divided by the probability of the uncrossing, where the uncrossing is the event where each of these nodes is in a separate tree. Okay. So one way to compute the number of trees is to add an extra node and put edge weights epsilon connecting it to the other nodes. Take the limit as epsilon goes to zero. Divide by first dividing by epsilon and the number of nodes. Okay, so that's this limit in this case. And we're gonna denote that as delta epsilon. And delta can be factored so that the determinant here is just the determinant of lambda epsilon, which is the modification of the Dirichlet-Neumann matrix, adding epsilon along the diagonals, times the determinant of this submatrix, which we saw before was the number of spanning trees rooted at the nodes. So it's the number of uncrossing configurations. So if we take this determinant and divide by this determinant, that gives us and divide by epsilon n and take the limit, this gives us this probability, and at the same time, well, okay, so if we take the same limit for the determinant of lambda epsilon, that tells us how to compute this ratio. Okay, so another way to compute that limit is just to take lambda, strike out a row and column, and take the determinant. Okay, so if you look at this new graph, in which every vertex is one of the original nodes, all the internal vertices have been removed, and there's an edge connecting two nodes with weight given by these L variables, then this ratio is just given by a weighted sum of spanning trees on this graph. So for example, if there are four nodes, we have a polynomial with 16 terms, each of which corresponds to the 16 different spanning trees on this graph. Okay, so it turns out to be useful to look at other groves on this graph. So here, this was a grove in which all these nodes are on the same tree, but we could, for example, look at a grove in which 1 and 2 are connected and 3 and 4 are connected. And if we look at the weighted sum of groves on this graph of this partition type, that's just L12 times L34. And so that's this term. Or if we look at L123 in one part, and 4 in its own part, there are three groves in which that happens, and one of them, for example, is where there's an edge between 1 and 2, and an edge between 2 and 3, and no other edges. So that contributes to this monomial. And there are three ways to do that, so we end up with this polynomial. Okay, so we're going to show that if you take the probabilities of the different partition types, divide by the probability of the uncrossing, and that normalization is just denoted by these dots here. And these can be expressed in terms of the L sub taus as follows, while agreeing to these equations. Okay, so this is another way of summarizing the previous equations. So these partitions are the non-crossing partitions. And the way to read this, and these are the all partitions, the way to read this is, for example, if we look at 1, 4, 2, 3, and if we want to know the normalized probability of seeing this partition type, this is given by L of 1, 4, 2, 3 minus L of 1, 3, 2, 4. So this portion of it turns out to be the identity matrix. And so in that sense, it's you can view this as a projection from the space of all partitions to the space of non-crossing partitions. Okay, so there's a similar set of formulas that holds for the double dimer model. And here, instead of looking at the L variables, the right variables to look at are these variables that are defined according to this following example. So recall that in ZVW, the black odd nodes went to one side and the even white nodes went with them. So here, it's the same rule, except that we make an exception for nodes I and j. So 2 is excluded, and it was included here. And 7 is included here, where it was excluded here. And if you look at the ratio of the number of dimer configurations here to the number of dimer configurations here, this is this x variable. And okay, so these are the double dimer pairing probabilities. They turn out to be given by polynomials in these x variables. Some more. So each of the monomials here turns out, if you look at it, every index occurs exactly once, and all the odd indices occur with an even index. And so the monomials can be identified with pairings. And so we can write out a similar matrix here. Which allows us to evaluate the probability of seeing this non-crossing pairing in terms of products of those x variables, which are given according to these pairings.
I missed what did the numerical value for the index mean?
What do they mean? I'll get to that later.
What?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
What's the difference between having -1, -2, and 1 and all of that?
It's like coefficients.
Okay.
So for each non-crossing pairing, there's a polynomial which gives the crossing probability, and the individual monomials, the polynomial, correspond to the columns. And the entries of the matrix tell you what coefficient there is.
Yeah, non-crossing pairings and all pairings.
Yes. No, not all pairings. These are odd-even pairings. I mean, you can list all pairings, but then you'd have a bunch of zeros. Okay. So for the groves, the rows were indexed by non-crossing partitions. For the dimers, they're indexed by non-crossing pairings, and of course they're the same number of them in both cases because there's this bijection between them. But the columns, well, they have different numbers of columns, and anyway, that's some reason to believe that this theory is only going to work for like a small number of different values of kappa. So there's something special about groves and double dimers. Each of them corresponds to a non-planar generalization to a planar Catalan structure. Okay, so anyway, we're gonna return to groves. So there's a bilinear form partitions, which is defined as follows. So this is this partition, one is by itself, 2, 7, and 8 are in a part, 3, 4, and 5 are in one part, and 6 is by itself. This is F partition. And when you put them together, this is a meander. This meander has a single loop, and so the bilinear form here is q to the 1. So the 1 corresponds to the fact that this one loop. This is another inner product. In this case, there were 3 loops. There's this outer loop, there's this loop, and that loop. And so it's q cubed. This is a multiplication table. So if you pick your favorite entry, for example, this one, here there are 3 loops, and so this should be q cubed. So anyway, so we call this the meander matrix, but the more common name is the Gram matrix of the temporally linked algebra. And Cohen-Simonsky determined when this matrix is singular. DiFrancesco, Gilanelli, and Guiter went further and gave an explicit diagonalization of it. And it's also been studied by other people. For example, von Jones determined what is positive definite. But the key facts that we're going to use are that it's non-singular when q is 2. And if you first divide by q and then send q to 0, it's also non-singular. So the q equals 2 case we're going to need for the double dimer model, and sending q to 0 after first dividing by q is going to be relevant to the groves. Yes.
You take the pairing all with equal weight except for q, the number of groups.
Right. Okay, so returning back to this bilinear form, if we first divide by q and send q to 0, you notice that we get 1 precisely when there's one loop, which is precisely when it's the case that if you glue the nodes together according to the partition sigma, and you have a groove of type tau before the gluing, that after the gluing, you end up with a spanning tree. And in this case, you want to get a spanning tree, and the bilinear form is 0. Okay, so if we look at the graph G sigma, which you get by gluing the nodes together according to the partition sigma, the number of trees in that graph is then just a summation over tau's, partitions tau, of groves of type tau in the original graph, such that if you were to glue the nodes together, the result would be a tree. So that's an easy identity. And this is the same equation in matrix vector notation. G sub sigma is defined to be this. M is this meander matrix in the limit when q goes to 0, normalized. And Z is it's the number of crossings, weighted sum of crossings of type tau. And for convenience, we're going to normalize by ZG of the uncrossing, dividing here, and also dividing there. And that's actually what G sigma is. Okay. So recall the form. formula for ZG of a tree over ZG of the uncrossing. That this was a polynomial in the L's. Now, if you glue the nodes together according to sigma, ZG of the uncrossing stays the same. If you glue the nodes according to sigma, the L matrix is modified by adding L's in the original matrix. And so if you look at this ratio, this is still a polynomial in the L's. And if we go back to this equation, we didn't actually use planarity here. And this holds true if you sum over all partitions tau, not just the planar ones. And in particular, it holds for the complete graph with the edge weights given by the L's. And in this case, Z sub tau is just trivially equal to L sub tau. Okay, so since these are equal, we'll just write them over here. And now if we assume that the graph is planar, well, Z sub tau for a planar graph is going to be 0. And so, okay, so E here is, it's like the meander matrix except there are extra columns which correspond to the non-planar partitions. But we can truncate it in the case of planar graphs to just the M portion. And because M was non-singular, we can invert it and pull it to this side. And this gives the Z sub taus in terms of the L sub taus. So this shows that these normalized crossing probabilities are given by polynomials in the L's. Now this M inverse so M inverse is going to have general rational entries, and so a priori it's not clear that if you take this product that it would be integer valued, but it turns out to be integer valued, and we'll see why in just a moment. So this is just the equation from above, I mean from the previous slide, and P we're just going to define to be this product. So this was that matrix I showed earlier with the rows indexed by the non-crossing partitions and the columns indexed by the YL partitions. Okay, so this is just the same thing as this, written out in summation notation. And that was how I interpret the rows of this matrix, T. And we can interpret the columns as follows. So if we take a summation over all the planar partitions of P sigma tau times sigma, and rho is any planar partition. Well, this is just using the fact that it's a bilinear form. The inner product between rho and sigma is m rho sigma. And this is just the entry of a product of these matrices. And because P was m inverse E, this is E sub rho tau. And that's just the inner product between rho and tau. And so the interpretation of the tauth column is that it gives a linear combination of non-crossing partitions that's equivalent to the partition tau in the sense that for any non-crossing partition rho, it's going to have the same inner product. And because the matrix M is non-singular, if you have one such linear combination that's equivalent to tau, you're not going to have any other ones. So if we have some method of computing these equivalent linear combinations that will allow us to compute the columns of the matrix, And if you do this for all the columns, then you get these crossing probabilities. Okay, so the way to read this is that if you imagine a vector space whose basis vectors are indexed by the partitions, this is just normal vector addition, and the vector notation has been suppressed. And I'm going to claim that this sum of partitions is equivalent to that sum of partitions under the previous rule. And to give an example, if we have row, which has 2 and 3 in one part, 1 by itself and 4 by itself, then this sequence of inner products is, in this case, 2 and 3 are arrayed together. You don't get a tree, so you get 0. 2 and 3, if you glue them together, you get one part. So that's this inner product is 1, and so on. And so on the left-hand side, we get 2. If you do the same thing on the right-hand side, you also get 2. There's some finite list of rows to consider, and if you try any of one of them, it works. And so you have this equivalence. Okay, so there's another rule. If you have some partition expressed as an equivalent linear combination of non-crossing partitions, you can add a new part to everything on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, and they're still equivalent. Or you could alternatively take any item and replace it with j, n, and do that on both the left and the right-hand sides. And that's still equivalent. And of course, you can relabel the items, and you would still have an equivalence. So to give an example, 1, 3, 2, 4 is equivalent to this. We can expand 1 into 1, 5. Then we can add a new part. And then we can relabel. And this would tell us how to express this particular partition in terms of an equivalent linear combination of non-crossing partitions. And the claim is that you can use these rules to express any partition in this way. So you can do this by induction on the number of parts. If you ignore one of the items and solve it inductively, and put the item back in, if it was a singleton, then you have the one rule to do that. Otherwise, it's in the same part as some other item. Okay, so now we want to use the crossing rule to express this partition in terms of non-crossing partitions, and then add the other items on the right-hand side, the other items on the left-hand side, add the new parts, and so on. And so you can express this partition as an equivalent linear combination of finer partitions. And it's best to do the induction on the parts that cross this, starting with the part closest to J. And I won't go through the details for why that's true, but in any case, it works. And the few minutes that I have left, I'm just going to indicate the corresponding thing for the double dimer model, so that it's not completely mysterious. Okay, so we'll skip those. So it's convenient to assume that the nodes alternate in color, and you can assume this without loss of generality by adding little spurs if the nodes have the wrong color. So instead of Kirchhoff matrices, we use Castellan matrices. So it's a matrix whose determinant is the square of the number of perfect matchings. For bipartite graphs, there's a smaller matrix for which you don't have to take the square root. Okay, so this is a combinatorial fact. What this is saying is that if you split the nodes appropriately, so if you have like the left graph with nodes S and the right graph with nodes from the complement of S, this gives the double dimer configurations that you get are the ones for which there's a pairing connecting nodes of S to nodes that aren't in S. And as a special case, you can take S to be the empty set, and this gives all double dimer configurations. And we can define DS as follows. So that's just this above equation. So this comes from the theory of, it comes from Castellan theory. X's are entries of the inverse Castellan matrix up to sign. And if you take a subdeterminant, then you can, well, compute these things. If you have this M matrix, and you take this product, you get the Meander matrix with parameter q equals 2. That's because, so if you take two of these and you glue them together, if you have two of these pairings, you get these loops. And for each loop, you have a choice of two ways to decide which item went into S and which one into S complement. I'm just going to gloss through this pretty quickly. This is expanding the determinant. This sign turns out to be minus 1 to the number of zeros that cross. And if you do summation of this over pairings that don't bridge S to S complement, you can manipulate this and discover that the pith row of M transpose D is equal to the pith row of this extended Meander matrix times this vector of X primes that are defined as follows. And then in the end, you end up doing something similar, where the pairing probabilities are given by this matrix times these x's. And for the double dimer model, the corresponding ad hoc rule is this one. And you can do similar manipulations and discover the L entries here are integer valued. So I'll stop here.